just makes me feel like saying, hey, how you doing? I'm Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor. You're here on DemRadio.com. You can listen to me every night on Dem Radio, 9 o'clock, 10:30. Love it. I'm here live at the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. So I came in a little bit early and harassed the old Ikester, who I like talking to because I just think he's an interesting guy. Anyway, but I heard him chatting about something similar to what I was going to kind of go off on today. And that is these continual bombing, killing of boats in the Caribbean by the Trump administration. You know, no trial necessary, no discussion. This, we say we should trust the government, right? We must trust the government to make sure that we're not just blowing people up. So let's give you a couple of examples here, just for anybody knows I'm talking about the boats that are alleged drug smuggling boats leaving from Venezuela somewhere, and then they get a little bit out, and then they get just blown up, and no discussion, no hey, that wouldn't happen to be your wife on board that doesn't have anything to do with it, would it? You know, the one that's forced to get on and come with you, and you blow up the boat anyway. Or what if your 6-year-old son's in the hold? Does that stop him from blowing up the boat? I don't know. Probably not. Ike had some interesting comments on it, and I was listening, and so I came in and began to rap with him about it. And he has his views. I have mine. They coincide in many ways, and then again, sometimes they don't, which is okay. You know, everybody's, I appreciate other points of view, and I don't presume to tell anybody. They can believe what they want, or they have to believe like me. I don't give a rip, you know, I just believe what I believe, and I usually attempt to back it up with my own beliefs. So, in keeping with that tonight, I have two things I want to talk about. One, I had some time to go over the Auto Pen fiasco and the evidence that, you want to call it that, the document that I downloaded for JR, and I was able to go through it in a fairly detailed fashion, so that'll be kind of fun. But before I do that, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about something called Article 17 of the 1988 United Nations Convention against the Illicit Traffic in Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances. It's in short, they call it the Illicit Traffic by Sea. And so I'm going to read you parts of this, okay? Basically, what it starts out with, the parties shall cooperate to the fullest extent possible to suppress illicit traffic by sea in conformity with the international law of the sea. Okay. What Article 17 provides in plain English is it provides assistance to suppress at sea, which means if a state suspects a vessel flying its own flag, a U.S. ship flying a U.S. flag, or without a flag or marks of registry, is used for drug trafficking, it may ask other states for help. Those asked shall render assistance within their means. So if somebody asks you, then you have to, or you shall render assistance. Okay? That's if it's under your own flag. A suspect vessel under another flag. If a state suspects a vessel on the high seas is engaged in illicit traffic, and it flies the flag of another state, country, it may, one, notify the flag state, two, request confirmation of registry, and if confirmed, three, request authorization from the flag state to take appropriate measures. The flag state, what the flag state may authorize, this they can authorize something. Authorizations can include A, boarding the vessel, B, searching the vessel, C, if evidence is found, taking appropriate action regarding the vessel, persons, and cargo. This is United Nations treaty language we're talking about, which the U.S. is a part of. We'll get to that in a minute. Safety and interests that are protected. All action must account for safety of life, I repeat, at sea. Security of the vessel or cargo, and avoid prejudicing commercial or legal interests of the flag state or other interested states. Conditions by the flag state. The flag state may attach conditions, including on responsibility, to any authorization that they grant. Fast responses and designated authorities. States must respond expeditiously to registry and authorization requests and must designate an authority to receive, respond. This designation is notified via whom? The UN Secretary General within 1 month. Informing, so they have, the UN has to be notified of this, you know, even after the fact. Informing of results. Any state that takes action under Article 17 must promptly inform the flag state of the outcome. They have to encourage bilateral and regional agreements. States should consider agreements to implement or enhance Article 17 cooperation. Only government ships and aircraft. Enforcement actions under the previous, may be carried out only by warships, military aircraft, or clearly marked government service vessels or aircraft. Coastal state rights preserved. Any action must not interfere with coastal state rights or jurisdiction under the international law of the sea. Okay? This is on page 197, 198 of the UN Treaty Series PDF. You can find that online. Check it out. So, the U.S. is a signatory to this agreement. It was signed by the U.S. the 20th of December, 1988 in Vienna. It was ratified by the United States on the 20th of February of 1990. And the convention, all of it, entered into force on the 11th of November of 1990, thus binding the U.S. from that date, since the U.S. had already ratified it before it entered into force. Now, the U.S. put a exclusion and said, we're not bound by Article 32, which regards dispute settlement. So they said, we're not bound by one article, but we are bound by the rest. They ratified it. It's a treaty. It's a law of the United States. Okay? So that's how you do it. I think an appropriate response is not to blow up a ship. I just don't think that's appropriate. I don't know. I had a discussion with Ike about it and said, you know, in my view, it's just un-American, you know. We don't, I don't agree with that. I gave him an example of way back when I was practicing law, and there were some drug runners that I was dealing with and helping to defend in court. You know, give the example of, let's say you know they're drug runners, and you know they're coming up from Oklahoma and Texas, and that they are bringing drugs through the United States. Does that authorize blowing them up or killing them just because? And let's say you absolutely know. And what difference does it make if it's on the sea or in a car or in a truck or in anything? Those are just a few comments that I have. And I'm going to go into a little bit further based on this. But I also thought it might be interesting to point out that Venezuela is also a party to this agreement, this treaty. They signed it on the 20th of December, 1988, same day in Vienna, Austria. They ratified it on the 16th of July of 1991, and thus Venezuela is also bound by this convention. Upon joining, Venezuela filed interpretive declarations. The convention is not a legal basis to extradite Venezuelan citizens, and controlled delivery applies only insofar as that is consistent with the national law. So they put two exceptions on there, that their national law deals with criminal sorts of penalties and investigations and all that sort of thing. But in general, everybody is bound by this, and I've given you what Article 17 requires. And obviously, we're not doing it. We're not. And I suppose you could say, well, why would we? I don't know. Sounds curious, doesn't it? But I want to go into just a short little diatribe about this. And if you feel like calling in, it's an interesting topic. And I do appreciate other points of view. So if you feel like diving in with me, 573-746-8020, and I'd be happy to chat with you. Let's see. So basically, what's the difference between the law of the sea, which I just read to you, and bomb first and ask questions later? I mean, you know, like me, let's ask questions later, like, is there perhaps a spouse on board? Maybe she didn't do anything, or him. Maybe there's a kid on there. Maybe there's a 15-year-old daughter of somebody that, you know, might look like an adult, but isn't. You just blow up the boat. You don't, it doesn't matter who's there, nothing. So if you're a cop at sea, does the badge turn your torpedoes into a gun to fire willy-nilly because you don't like the look of the boat? Or your best friend told you that somebody's carrying drugs? The high seas is supposed to run on rules. What are ours? The rule book on the high seas, a ship answers to its own flag state. Other states can only board for very narrow reasons: piracy, slave trade, statelessness, or with flag state consent for drug states. That's 1988 Vienna Convention, Article 17, that I already outlined to you. Even then, force has to be necessary, reasonable, and aimed not to endanger life. That isn't poetry. That's not Sam. That is black letter law of the sea. Okay? Let's look at this. The something called the SIGA rule is the international sea law that you hit. You know, you have to warn them first, de-escalate, and not endanger life when enforcing law at sea. So in this case, which was a 1999 case, the international law of the sea case, 1999, Guinea used excessive force, and the tribunal said, nope, can't do that. And it wrote the standard for the whole new world that the world cites now. So, you know, maybe we could have a mug for, you know, to provide for the president and his crowd that says life over seizures, or maybe put it in a on a t-shirt or something. There's another case, a case of Guyana versus Suriname. Threats are force as well. Suriname pointed guns at a drilling rig. And what did the tribunal say? That is an unlawful threat of force. That is not law enforcement. So what's the translation? Menacing a civilian vessel crosses the line. Bombing it, you know, we have pole vaulted over the line, right? Let's give you another case. Soundbite number three. It's at this one. Well, I can't play it because it's another language. I had to translate it. I'm alone, deja vu, Canada versus the United States. The Coast Guard sank a Prohibition era rum runner called I'm Alone on the high seas, and the U.S. ended up paying. Okay. That was nearly a century ago. Nearly a century later, the warning is still a valid warning. You know, the you sink a smuggler at sea, expect a legal bill and a, you know, diplomatic migraine headache. So how are drug cases supposed to work? Well, I read you how the Article 17 works. For narcotics, the flags use flag state consent under Vienna 1988 and regional agreements if they have any. Council of Europe's Article 17 implementing pact, there is one. You hail, you pursue, you board, you seize, and you arrest. If you must use force, it's warning shots, then engine disabling fire, deadly force only to protect life. That is the U.S. playbook on paper, right? Department of Homeland Security, U.S. Coast Guard policy. Sinking comes after the rescue or to remove a hazard, not as a rolling punishment from 10,000 feet, right? So why does it matter? Because since early September, Washington has carried out a string, I can't tell you anymore, I think it's close to 10, of missile and airstrikes on small boats in the Caribbean and now in the Eastern Pacific, killing dozens. With Colombia, UN experts, and plenty of law of the sea nerds crying foul. Even if you wanted a tough anti-cartel message, the law enforcement paradigm still governs on the high seas. You can't just declare an all-ocean war. So under the law that actually exists, the sequences hail, board, seize, prosecute. What we've seen is detect, allegedly, strike, absolutely, and bury the evidence. That is not enforcement. That's extrajudicial shortcut in a splash zone. This is crap, in my opinion. Let's talk about human rights, okay? Human rights, I don't believe, are tethered to someone's zip code. You know, human rights are human rights. If your agents control or target people at sea, your obligations travel with them, right? Our obligation for law enforcement isn't to, you know, you leave the border, suddenly you can kill whoever you want, but that's how we're doing it. This is wrong. Here's another one. Hirsi Jamad in 2012. The court held that acts by state vessels on the high seas trigger that state's human rights jurisdiction. How do you like this? So if the U.S. takes an action on the high seas against a criminal ship from another jurisdiction, another country, our human rights jurisdiction is triggered, which means they should get the same treatment as a citizen because we're bombing them. Huh. How do you like that? That's law. This is law. This is precedent. It's already been done. We're not doing it. So why doesn't the rest of the world trust us? we create whatever rules we want. Treaty, no treaty, doesn't matter. We just do what we want. If you intercept or push back migrants, your right to life duties follow you off the beach. The principle doesn't vanish when the target is a suspected smuggler. Here's a 1997 case, Haitian interdiction. The Inter-American Commission said that the U.S. interdiction program, stopping people, violated international law because it couldn't fairly assess any asylum claim and protected right at sea. Read that again with missiles in your head instead of boarding ladders. So I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm saying that's the state of the law right now. That if you are stopping Haitians and you are stopping them and turning them around, that as soon as you stop them and begin to question them, our human rights, our policies on, what do you call it? Asylum take effect. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's international law right there. Let's see. UN right to life baselines. Okay, the UN charter. Basic principles on the use of force and firearms. This is UN, which we ignore because we can. We do. Say that lethal force is for imminent threats to life only. Not for destroying evidence. Not for stopping property crime. And the Human Rights Committee's general comment number 36 hammers on that no arbitrary deprivation of life is allowed, even in emergencies and conflicts. That's what UN people are saying right now. So there's a group of human rights experts from the UN that calls these maritime kills, which is the same thing I call them, extrajudicial execution in international waters. Full stop. Warning of the UN charter breach and regional destabilization. Okay? We are breaking the UN charter. We are just doing what we feel like. Why? Because we have the bigger warships. And because we care about our own politics and what hopefully people look at this and go, yeah, get those drug runners. You don't know that they're drug runners. I mean, Jesus. I don't know how hard we have to push this. You know, how would you like do unto others? Let's talk about, you know, people call up, ask about Jesus. And I'm not against it. What, you know, do unto others, then split. Is that what it says in the, you know, do unto others and then get the hell out of here quick before somebody catches us? No, it's do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Isn't that how it goes, right? But no, we just blow them up now. Let's ask questions later, right? Or don't ask questions and go, what? We're like the kid sitting at the back of the bus shooting spitballs toward the front. You know, somebody looks back and catches, what? You know, that kid's a dick. And we can shoot him in the head. He started it, right? You know, look what he's doing. He's doing bad stuff. You know, I should therefore, you know, one horror story shouldn't beget another, right? So I'm very much against this. Maybe you can tell. What are our friends on the other side of the planet saying? This has been pretty blunt coverage. 6 killed in the Caribbean, 5 killed in the Pacific. There's probably more. Washington is calling this a war on cartels, but neighbors are calling it murder. That's what I call it. It's the Monroe Doctrine in deck shoes. We can do whatever we want. Why? Manifest destiny, baby. We're supposed to be there. You know, Colombia's government, normally pretty tight with Washington. And remember, Colombia used to be, you know, it's all nothing but drug lords. When I went to Colombia for New Year's, I don't know, year and a half, 2 years ago? Can't remember. Might only been, was it last year? You know, it might only been last year that I went for New Year's to Colombia. What a beautiful country. What a fantastic country. Maybe they do sell drugs there and they're drug lords, you know, growing stuff in the mountains. But I was way up in the mountains and it's freaking fantastic. And there are Americans everywhere. So, you know, riding bicycles all over the place, beautiful highways. I thought the U.S. might have purchased Colombia a long time ago, you know, because we've been trying to buy them out. You sure as hell don't want them in bed with China, according to the government. I don't give a crap, frankly. I just want a nice place to travel to. But, I don't want drugs going anywhere. But I sure as hell don't want to take all things American and just crap on them because, you know, we allege that there's somebody that, is running drugs, right? So we just blow them up. Execution. Execution is what this is. So if your law enforcement plan at sea is boom, splash, no boarding report, don't be shocked when the UN's, complaining that this is extrajudicial, because it is. You can't save American lives by skipping the very legal tests designed to separate criminals from fishermen. That's why the tests exist. You know, in our own country and internationally, there is zero excuse for this. Zero. I think it's a squirrel to look, you know, to get you to look the other way. Squirrel! You look, see the dog. Look over here. Don't pay attention to this. This is crap. Let's talk about the evidence problem. Washington has no public evidence that these boats, any of them, carried drugs, much less that these boats posed any imminent threat to life to anyone by drugs or otherwise. Reporters and regional officials say several routes targeted aren't even the main pathway for U.S.-bound fentanyl. Families of the dead say some were fishermen. Meanwhile, bodies and cargo are vaporized, so good luck litigating truth after that. Let's talk about effectiveness in the theater surrounding that. If the goal is interdiction, the Coast Guard, not air-to-surface munitions, should be the doctrine. The Government Accounting Office has dinged DHS and its partners for years on performance gaps related to drug enforcement, but the answer has never been skip boarding the boats at all. Even the DOD says when it does maritime law enforcement under U.S. Coast Guard control, it follows U.S. Coast Guard policy. Warning shots, engine stops, rescue, bomb first, is completely outside the bounds of legality. Backsplash. What's the horror story of this? You're normalizing sink on sight. You're writing the talking points for every state that wants to shoot first at boats it doesn't like. Does that mean that up in the Baltic Sea, the Lithuanians see a Russian tanker ship that is, or a ship suspected of carrying Russian oil, does that mean they can blow it up? I mean, that's a legal activity, right? They're breaking sanctions. Depending on how you look at it, I suppose. But it's nonsense. You know, you just blow it up. That's why the threat of force is unlawful. Remember the Guyana versus Suriname case? Because there's precedent. We've done this before, but we ignore it. We completely ignore it. This is nonsense and B freaking S. So between September and now, media accounts put the dead in dozens. AP, Guardian, Al Jazeera, Reuters, and even RT, Russia Today, all tally fatal strikes and widening geography. They've gone from the Caribbean to the Pacific. Colombia and Venezuela have taken this issue to the UN. This isn't niche. It's on the floor of the Security Council, where Russia's the president till the end of the week. What to say to, but it works. You know, if somebody comes to you and says, but wait a minute, this works. If you mean by works, people die and there's a boom, sure. But is this law enforcement? This is crap. Law enforcement is supposed to be an accountable process, a professional accountable process. The Coast Guard's own history and DHS policies, you warn them, you board them, you collect evidence, and then you prosecute. You don't pre-detonate the chain of custody, so there is no evidence. I mean, this is nuts. Where do we get to the big boy package? Where do we get to the... Remember they always used to talk about the grown-ups entering the room? I hate to think that I myself am actually a grown-up, but let me give a couple of suggestions. What if we recenter flag state consent and boarding under Vienna 1988 Article 17 workflow? Publish monthly stats, requests, approvals, interdictions, prosecutions. If the route is real, we'll see it. We'll be able to see it, right? Follow the force ladder. Hail, warn, disable, rescue. No lethal fire unless imminent threat to life. So if you're bombing somebody from 10,000 feet, I mean, you're not even there. You don't even have to be, but you make sure to video it, right? Oh, watch, we're going to get these guys. We're going to blow them up. This is going to be great. And you blow them up, and you make sure you got a video. And if you can do that, why can't you at least wait and see if they're going to be a threat to you when you pull up your Coast Guard cutter? Why don't you track them? I mean, obviously, you got a video of the blowing them up out in international waters. Why can't you track them? I don't know. What about put body cams on boats? Seriously, what if you require sensor and video capture, airframe, ship frame, before any sort of threat? Auto release sanitized clips within 30 days, absent operational harm. If you can post the strike video, you can post the boarding refusal video too, can't you? I don't know. What about a regional task force? Fund the a regional task force. Operations that put boarding teams on the water with partner Navy or Coast Guard. Government accounting office says performance is lagging anyway, so solve that with assets, not with air-to-surface, you know, missiles. What about right-to-life training? I mean, don't you think that UN basic principles, human basic principles, are you don't just go kill anybody? You know, people should have to watch this. If troops can recite what the escalation of force is, they should be able to say lethal only to protect life. This isn't the protection of life. This is the destruction of a boat from 10,000 feet. How is that protecting anything? I mean, zero evidence. What do you got? Independent after-action review of every lethal maritime strike with a public summary. If you can't justify it to a judge or a journalist, you shouldn't be able to justify the missile. So, I don't know. That's about all I got on this topic for tonight. I mean, call me old-fashioned. Call me, I don't know what, a pacifist. I'm not. But if you claim a boat is a floating pharmacy, maybe you should board it and show me the pills before you turn it into an addition to the coral reef below. Otherwise, you're just conducting law by explosion, and yet another do what I say. You know, tell me this is what it is, and law for thee, but not for me. We don't have to. Other people have to follow those treaties. We don't have to. We're America. Why the heck would we follow that? I mean, come on. These people are drug runners. We need to blow them up, right? I don't believe that. I think it's nonsensical nonsense. So, I don't know. I think, so, and here's my comparison for you. So, I brought that up, and I wanted to talk about it tonight on purpose, because I have another topic that I'm going to get into over the next hour, and I'm hoping I have enough time to get through it, because it's a lot of content, and it is the Biden auto pen that people have been talking about, especially since that report came out yesterday. And I've got some stuff for you. So basically, this report, it zeroes in on the wrongdoing by Biden-era apologists for his condition. Let's talk about who's implicated in the auto pen chain and why. What was signed by auto pen with a special focus on the pardons. And then a summary of witnesses that, because there were a decent amount of witnesses interviewed. And I've gone through them all. Okay. And basically, there was a cover-up and then manipulation of the auto pen after this. So let's take a quick look at this. So I want to talk about the severity level, high severity, those that interfered with illegal or process integrity, right? The use of the auto pen for presidential actions without a robust contemporaneous approval process. Like, for example, handwritten signatures recommended by White House lawyers for pardons were not followed. Approvals routed by email or staff sent messages as principals. Some approvals were outsourced to the vice president per a memo that was talked about. And then there was concealing and stonewalling on who actually operated the auto pen. And nobody tracked whether documents, including clemency documents, were hand-signed or auto-pen signed. Chief of Staff Zients could not name the operator of the auto-pen. How do you like that? And the executive clerk's office is allegedly the one who pushed the button. So those are pretty high severity. That is, those are things being done that are supposed to be done by the president that were done by somebody else. Then there's ones that are medium sorts of severity. Deception, obstruction of public understanding, centralized communication strategy that fed press room binders with prepared lines, calling everything a cheap fake, and sidestepped the physician on health specifics. KJP, Kim Jean-Pierre, whatever her name was, said the binder didn't note authorship. You know, she didn't know who wrote it. She just read it. And they never talked about who was the medical authority, never brought him into the room. And then they had actual Hollywood coaches and stage management. So on delivery, language, minimizing steps and walks, how to do this, maintain optics despite internal concerns that were really there. Those are medium. And then they have some lower severity, political spin, control of the narrative, that type of thing. And they would all, you remember these, they would always dismiss public concerns about cognition as mere age talk or public speculation. And this was even after the HER report described Biden as an elderly man with a poor memory. So the bottom line, the report, the whole of it, frames process violations as the gravest exposure. Comms and optics misconduct is systematic, and spin and denial is pervasive. The committee asks the Department of Justice to investigate and treat auto pen signed executive action as void. That's actually in it. Okay. So let's talk about the chain of the auto pen, who they questioned and why. They questioned Jeff Zients, chief staff, could not identify who physically operated the auto pen, permitted staff routed email approvals. His aide, Rosa Poe, emailed as him to authorize the auto pen. So he didn't even see them. This Rosa Poe did. Communication teams controlled talking points on Hunter Biden pardon, never even ran it by him. Then there's the press secretary, Neera Tanden. She oversaw auto pen processing, but did not track whether the president hand-signed or used the auto pen. She relied on the executive clerk to flag auto pen items, and she only saw them later in her tenure. Guy named Bruce Reed, Deputy Chief Staff, Ed Siskel, White House Counsel, in the approval routing and legal risk loop. They are cited in testimony around auto pen process and debate, but no real process. David Kalbaugh, who's an executive clerk, his office likely operated the auto pen per testimony and was the center of mechanical execution. This Rosa Poe on Zeint's staff, she sent the auto pen authorization as Jay-Z, as Zeint's, email in the Hunter Biden pardon. So it was Rosa Poe that sent it. Ron Klain, former chief staff, acknowledged verbal authorizations were sometimes used, like vaccine mandate defense memo, rather than formal sign-off procedures. And then the vice president's office, the report cites a memo indicating auto pen operations and approvals were at times, they didn't say how many too, outsourced to the vice president. Why are there being questions? Because the approval process is opaque, not transparent. Email in lieu of formal sign-off or verbal. Non-tracking of the hand versus auto pen. Unknown who operated it physically, and policy and legal memos urged hand signature for pardons that was completely disregarded. So, let's see. What was actually signed by auto pen? At least 32 of 51 clemency warrants in the Biden years were auto pen signed. This is according to the Oversight Project. The January 19, 2025 pardons, the ones right before he left office. Five members of the Biden family, auto pen. Dr. Fauci, auto pen. Mark Milley, auto pen. Members of the House January 6 Select Committee and their staffs. The report says many of these were auto pen signed. And links to DOJ's pardons granted by President Biden for the master list. White House legal memoranda recommend hand signatures on pardons, but instead approvals arrive by email from this Poe lady. Wow. This document does not print a full recipient by recipient roster, so we don't have all the names, not in this one. But they just lump them all together and say many in the group were auto pen. For a complete roster, it points to the DOJ's pardon attorney's public log for the time period that Biden was in office. So here's what the witness testimony says in a nutshell. None of them are too horribly long, but there's like 10, 12 of them. So I'll tell you what they say. This Neera Tanden, who's staff secretary, she oversaw auto pen routing. She had no systematic tracking of hand versus auto pen. This is what she said. The executive clerk flagged auto pen items. Fewer cabinet meetings and distance from POTUS acknowledged elsewhere in findings. But that's her. Ashley Williams, Deputy Director of the Oval Office, described, this was on July 11th, described meticulous stage management of events, denied or deflected cognition talk as a public speculation, claimed any staff who needed access had it. The committee says that is not credible. Ron Klain, the chief of staff, he was interviewed on July 24. He admitted that verbal approvals replaced formal processes, and he pushed early debate to blunt age concerns, that he pushed it. After the debates were effed, the we're effed moment, he conceded that it was a very big political problem. Steve Ricchetti, who was interviewed on July 30, he denied that the debate proved cognitive struggle. He said, "I don't agree." He was involved in a withdrawal letter drafting where Biden was coming out of the race. He was accused in the report of withholding negative polls, but he denied it. Mike Donilon, senior advisor, he was interviewed July 31st. Financially incentivized by a campaign role, about $4 million, potentially $8 million. He was pressed to lighten Biden's schedule when Biden was tired. He was accused of controlling polling flow to POTUS. He didn't give it to him, but he denies that. Bruce Reed, the deputy chief of staff, was interviewed on August 5th. He said he was supposed to be in the auto pen approval loop, but he described Hollywood involvement in the debate prep. He gave a variant rationale on an earlier debate calendar, not age. He said it was, you know, all calendar. Anita Dunn, senior advisor for communications on August 7. She ran comms. She hired Bates and Sams, downplayed cognition as an age issue, and helped set the early debate and passed on these comms talking points to KJP. Ian Sams, the White House spokesperson, said he was part of the team that labeled HERS cognition rationale gratuitous in their press strategy. You know, that didn't need to be put out there, he said. Andrew Bates, senior press secretary, September the 5th, high volume communications operator. He was part of the tight senior managed message flow and limited POTUS access, according to his own stuff. Karine Jean-Pierre, press secretary, September 12th, relied on prepared talking points, especially with relation to the cheap fakes line. She referred health questions to communications, not to the physician. She admitted unknown authorship of binders, you know, for Kim Jong-Pierre or Kim Jong, whatever, however you say your name, denied recalling concerns at the time and acknowledged that there were contradiction by POTUS on China and Taiwan. So here's your chief of staff, Jeff Zients, acknowledged increasing stumbles and recall issues of the president. They were more common across time. Could not say who operated the auto pen. He noted donor concerns about teleprompters and the reliance thereon. And post-debate, he urged Biden to drop out. They also took some depositions. Dr. Kevin O'Connor invoked the Fifth Amendment. He sent a memo to KJP about neurologist visits and omitted cognition test details. The report paints him as complicit with political staff in, you know, making sure this went forward. Anthony Bernal, July 16th, invoked the Fifth Amendment also, listed as a close observer of the inner circle, but no information forthcoming. Annie Tomasini, deputy chief of staff for operations, July 18th, invoked the Fifth Amendment, alleged that she had control and over all access and scheduling to Biden. Question raised whether she discouraged medical review. Committee cites this report on internal wheelchair discussions, getting him a wheelchair. So this is unbelievable stuff, isn't it? Let's see. Where are we gonna go about this? So Dr. O'Connor was complicit, so this medical cover-up. The physician stonewalling, he invoked the Fifth rather than answer questions. The comms leaders, not the doctor, shaped health messaging, and KJP relied on prepared talking points. The Hollywood coaching was talked about. The workload lightening, you know, you need him because he was falling apart. And, I mean, we all saw this. It's not like we need some report later. We watched the man be a mess in there. And so, but his inner circle was all involved in this cover-up, right? I mean, this is unbelievable stuff. Let's see. I'm going to get to what the biggest parts of this are. The machinery, literally, the auto, you know, how you get the auto pen to work. It's not a metaphor. It's a device that reproduces a signature. It's harmless for routine letters, right? Cute even. Except this report says the machine wandered into the high church of state power, executive actions and clemency, pardons, commutations, the stuff where the Constitution expects a conscious and accountable human to say, yes, I, the president, choose this. Instead, we got, sure, hit the button. You know, press the button. Then we talk about the chain of custody that wasn't. In an alleged normal government, the path of a decision is documented. You know, kind of like the scene of a crime. Who has the file? Who briefed the president? Who signed? When? By hand or by machine? That's how it's supposed to go. But in Biden government, it's like some sort of scavenger hunt run by a bunch of interns on a caffeine cleanse. The president's decision materials move through aides, valets, residential staff, sometimes logs, most time not. Staff secretary, the person supposedly regarding this paper vault, saw the president only every 6 to 8 weeks and didn't track which documents he hand-signed versus auto-pen. That's in their own words, you know, they're talking about. This is me making crap up. So then they had the 2025 January 19 clemency sprint. The final hours pardon palooza. The report reconstructs this like a bad game of telephone tag. A meeting happens with a senior aide. Chief of staff isn't there. Aide calls the chief at home. Chief says, okay, use the auto pen. By email. Yes, by email. For multiple pardons. Then the staff secretary's office shuttles the order to the executive clerk team, who apparently physically hit the auto pen. Who actually operated the machine? Nobody knows. Who documented the president's direct approval on paper contemporaneously as the lawyer recommend for pardons? That's what we're looking out for. And so far, there's nothing there. And who was in the favored slice? The report says that state included 5 members of Biden's family, Dr. Anthony Fauci, General Milley, and members of the staff of the January 6th committee, like I told you. And then we got apologists, those people who go, you know, arrange the paper, approve the paper, explain the paper. Chief of staff says auto pen was versus hand was a logistics issue. Staff secretary oversaw the workflow but didn't track the difference. Executive clerk shop likely pressed the button, like I said. And then there's a communication shell game. Cheap fakes. They were told about the president's health. We're told it's all just age, just lighting, just cold, just the stairs. Press secretary reads talking points from a binder she didn't write and can't attribute who did. The president's doctor's a political fog machine whose paperwork omits the thing people actually wish to know. Hollywood is coaching the State of the Union like a Netflix pilot. And donors whisper about the teleprompter being glued to the podium. Let's talk about lawyers a little bit. You know, I love this part, right? White House counsel types reportedly advise that pardon should be hand signed. Not maybe, not if you have time, hand signed. Why? Because clemency isn't a ribbon cutting, it's one of the most serious acts a president takes. And yet, we have a process documented in this report, which you can download online, the Auto Pen Presidency, where email relays and verbal approvals are a substitute for the president's pen, and an auto scribbler gets to call like it, you know, you know, gets the call to, you know, do something like a pitcher in the bullpen in the ninth inning. The committee's conclusion on this, if you can't show the president actually approved it, void it. I'm not so sure I'm against that. I mean, I doubt it'll ever happen, but, you know, here you go. Let's see. I told you about the 32 of 51. What are the stakes? Is this just a gotcha about pens? I'm not so sure. It's about whether the presidency can delegate his presence without documentation. If you're going to run the modern White House like, you know, I don't know, like your, you know, Amazon shopping cart, okay. But you have, then you have to be a fanatic about who's doing the record keeping, who briefed what was decided, how it was memorialized, who signed, and what method they, you know, signed with. If you don't do that, you don't have a White House, right? So what do we do with all this? I'm not so sure anything will happen out of any of this. It's a grand little report. I mean, remember the 9/11 report? What the hell would we do with that? Except take away rights of normal Americans, right? What's anybody going to do on this? Nothing. So, I don't know. Remember this Tandon lady. I'm going to underline what she said, you know. I mean, think about this. Decision materials. This is a binder with memos, card, boxes, agree, disagree, discuss. The civics class stuff that proves a human with Article II powers actually read the words before the country had to live with them. Who owned this in the Biden White House? We know it wasn't Biden. It was the staff secretary's office, according to this report. In theory, they compiled, delivered, and retrieved items and ensured the president's physical signature ended up where it belongs. In practice, the staff secretary, Neera Tandon, saw the president once every 6 to 8 weeks, and she candidly described the heart of the process as a black box. Her team would send a binder over. Something would happen. The binder would return with a signature. She'd check that there was a signature, not whether it was his hand or a machine. That isn't chain of custody, you know. Let me say again. She said her role was extremely limited. She didn't watch the review. She didn't know who sat with the president when he, quote, decided. She didn't track whether the signature came from the man or the machine. She trusted that the protocol was working, but conceded that she wasn't present for most of it. That's like a notary who only sees the envelope after the fact, right? Who did touch the binder? According to Ashley Williams, Oval Office Ops, basically whoever. Some days an op staffer, other days a valet or someone from the residence staff ferried it. There was no formal list of who was authorized to carry the president's decision book. And when asked if there was a log, an actual record, of everyone who touched it, Williams confirmed that there was no log. So the country's most sensitive approvals commuted around the complex by the honor system. You know, I mean, maybe you have a proper hall pass, you know, it was given to you by somebody, right? If you got one, you wouldn't make that up. Who would? Even the return trip wasn't there. Sometimes the president handed it back directly. Sometimes Annie Tomasini carried it back. Sometimes, who knows? Williams says she can't even speak to a set protocol. No set protocol. That phrase should be engraved all over the whole section. No protocol. Imagine a police courtroom chain of custody for evidence. Now imagine the opposite. That's your executive action in the Biden White House, right? Now let's talk about the signature because in, you know, Washington, the pen is not just mightier than the sword, it's mightier than the subpoena. Who ensured the president personally hand-signed the big ones? Answer, no one. You can't get anyone under oath who will say, yep, I saw him sign that one. The staff secretary confirms her office didn't track anything, right? And they didn't track hand versus auto pen. So the people whose job was to memorialize the president's decision didn't record how it was memorialized. You know, if that was a bank, that would be akin to not putting a camera at the vault door. So when Sam, you know, the teller who has to go into the vault, you know, walks out with his hand stuffed with $100 bills or his pockets, nobody's going to see it because there's no there. Who had the keys to the auto pen? Tandon says she oversaw auto pen use, but did not operate it. She would alert the executive clerk, David Kalba, and his staff would actually auto pen the document. She admits she didn't witness the machine in use until very late in her tenure. So what's that translate to? The functional custody of the signature device lived in a shop that she did, you know, that she was in charge of, but didn't run. You know, she would pass it off to someone else. And the chief of staff, Jeff Zients, testified he did not know who physically auto-penned, operated it. Wow. What was the rule book? There's a draft decision memo on auto-pen use in February 2021 that actually reads fairly sane, like a sane set of guidelines. It includes a bright line recommendation, says right on it. Hand-signed pardon letters. Oh, that's sensible. Except 32 of 51 were not. And Zients says he personally never saw a breakdown prior to the prep for his interview. And practice diverged from that anyway. Even Tandon concedes the president did not hand-sign executive orders. So the memo that should have been a guardrail was ignored, unknown, or treated as nice to have. So you're not required to do anything. What did day-to-day operations really look like? I mean, I don't know. Let's picture a principal increasingly stage-managed. He was stage-managed. Fewer events, lighter schedule, teleprompter even at small fundraisers, and Hollywood whispers like Spielberg, Katzenberg, coaching delivery and language for the State of the Union and beyond. Is that illegal? No. But it's not a great look when mixed with paperwork that you can't tell who decided what when. Right? I mean, this place was a mess, according to this report. Wow. Verbal authorizations happened. Even though they were cited as a feature of, you know, of what shouldn't happen. Ron Klain admits that there were times the formal process was not followed. Decisions were made and later they were memorialized. The report's point is not that no one ever wrote anything down. It's that the writing was often after the fact and email-based and sometimes not from the person who supposedly made the decision. Isn't that crazy? So, I don't know. We're going to, there's so much to get through here. I'm going to go to, we already know, well, we have a lot of testimony on who ran or didn't run this piece. And let's see, I want to get to some of the clemency sprint is what I call it. Let's talk about the final hours of the White House. You know, they're playing DoorDash with the auto pen, right? This is January 19, 2025. A meeting in the West Wing, a phone call to the chief of staff at home, an email authorizing the auto pen for multiple pardons, and voila, robot signatures on some of the most sensitive acts a president can take. The report calls it a game of telephone tag. After reading this, you know, I call it, you know, malpractice myself. This is not how you get a presidential pardon. So here's how it worked, according to the steps that have been outlined in this report. Step one, the room where it happened. Senior aides Bruce Reed, Deputy Chief of Staff, Ed Siskel, White House Counsel, Steve Ricchetti, Annie Tomasini, Anthony Bernal met in person with President Biden on January 19 to discuss pardons. Notably not in the room, Chief of Staff Jeff Zients. Okay, now there's the relay. Who carried the decision out of that room? Zients assumed it was Reed or Siskel, but he didn't know. So when the chief of staff has to assume who carried the president's ideas out of the room, you already lost. Reed and Siskel reportedly deliver the gist of it all to Rosa Poe, the assistant, the assistant of Zients. Then, so that's the relay of information. So first you have the meeting, then the relay. Third one is the call. Poe, his assistant, called Zients at home. She gives him the telephone, you know, game, secondhand summary of what was decided in a meeting that he didn't attend, and neither did she. No contemporaneous decision memo is produced. Nothing. Zip. Step four, there's an email. Without calling back into the room, without confirming with anyone who was actually present, Zients says that Poe can send an email from his account signed with his initials approving the use of the auto pen to sign multiple pardons. Once again, the authorization for a robot to sign clemency warrants is a staff-sent email from the chief of staff's inbox. Okay, that's step four. Step five, the button. Poe hits send, right? The secretary's staff secretary's office conveyed to someone, and that someone used the auto pen to sign the warrants. Zients admits he doesn't know who actually operated the auto pen. Neither does anybody else, apparently. In any sane procedure, who pressed the button isn't a mystery. It's supposed to be logged. Here, it's just, you know, folklore. It's like, I don't know, Bigfoot. We have the auto pen. We used to have Bigfoot. Now, this is another legend out there. Now, if you're hoping the paper trail gets better, hold on. The report says these January 19 pardons included the five Biden members, Dr. Fauci, General Milley, and members of the staff of the January 6th committee. That's not me making that up. That's document about what it says in the auto pen email. And it wasn't just the who, it's the how, the White House described the broader clemency push that week. On January 17, the White House boasted of commuting sentences for nearly 2,500 people convicted of nonviolent drug offenses. A record-setting, history-making headline. Then a senior DOJ ethics attorney, Bradley Weinsheimer, weighed in with a memo that basically says, stop saying nonviolent because it's untrue, or at least misleading. He lists cases with violence in the offense of conviction or violent histories. The 19 flagged as highly problematic. Of the 19 flagged as highly problematic, 16 still got clemency. His line that should have frozen, you know, that should be frozen. I have no idea if the president was aware of these backgrounds. The department was largely excluded from the process. That's not that, you know, that's not me saying that. That's DOJ. So the constitutional pardon power is a personal power of the president. The president must decide. The report's remedy section says the quiet part out loud to all of us. Treat auto pen executed actions as void where there's no contemporaneous record of the president's own approval. They recommend that DOJ review Biden-era executive actions on that basis. What does that mean in plain English? If you can't prove the boss said yes, The robot signature shouldn't be able to rescue you. Right? This is never going to happen, by the way, but it's people can now put it on paper and go, well, I told them they should do this, but nothing's going to happen, just so you know. Now let's go back to January 19th, because the effects are three. One, no decision memo for the most sensitive category of presidential act, right? That is the headline. You know, there's no decision memo, no decision by the president. The telephone relay. The chief of staff wasn't in the meeting. An aide relayed the decision. Another aide emails the authorization. Another, somebody unknown, signs it. That's prove it, you know, that's rumor mill, right? The robot signature on clemency documents, despite a draft auto pen memo saying, don't do that, hand signed. But defenders will say, auto pen is lawful. Verbal decisions are still decisions, and emails are a record. Sure, but only if you can show the president made the decision then and that that method matched the category's seriousness. Here we have an absence where the record should be, an email where a signature should be, and a machine where the man should be. You know, it gets worse, friends and neighbors. The report surfaces a briefing memo of February 23rd, 2024, by White House Deputy Associate Counsel Issa Kasem, suggesting the vice president's approval had been sufficient to obtain the president's approval for a particular clemency package. Zients says he never saw it and blows it off as a junior draft. Maybe so. But drafts don't draft themselves, and the sentence does exist. In a healthy system, that line would hopefully supposed to be a guardrail, but it isn't, okay? Paying attention to who had a seat in pardon discussions is problematic, too. The report flatly says that Zients testified that Hunter Biden was included in meetings about pardons, including the meetings tied to the January 19 slate of family members, Fauci, Miller, and all those other, Emily, and all those others. So the president's son is involved in his own pardon discussion. Chief of staff isn't even in the room, and the authorization is an email sent by an aide to the chief of staff and blessed by an auto pen. Farging believable. The culture around this sprint matters quite a bit too. The same section of the report says a presidency was increasingly stage managed. Makeup, walking step counts, teleprompters, Hollywood coaches, and delivery on language, comms machine, and note cards who nobody knows who wrote and the press secretary can't identify. It's crazy. Wow. You can argue the president gave an oral yes in the room, and the email was a ministerial relay, and the auto pen is just a mechanical extension. If that's true, produce the record that ties the president's decision to the specific warrants authorized, the 2,500. Why don't we start with that? Show the decision memo. Show an initial. Show the date and time, the list. Did he do 2,500 all at once? Or did he review each and every one? I guarantee you he didn't. So the bottom line, January 19 pipeline was meeting, relay, phone, email, auto pen with no decision. This is nuts. Nuts. The apologists, you know, well, they're all there. It's the same people. What's their alleged wrongdoing? Jeff Zients, green lighting executive memo for or method for auto pen for clemency with no decision. This Neera Tendran, who only participated, you know, once every 6 to 8 weeks. Not criminal, but institutional negligence, failure to track signatures that, have legal force to them. David Kalba, executive clerk, hands on the hardware, but nobody can prove who it was. His alleged wrongdoing was executing signatures in a system where authorization is unrecorded or email-based from somebody not even there. Bruce Reed, Ed Siskel, Steve Ricchetti, Annie Tomasini, Anthony Bernal, The Room, right? What is their wrongdoing? Opaque relay of presidential decisions without contemporaneous documentation. Ashley Williams, not a criminal, but again, procedural dereliction of duty. System practically invited unverifiable authors. And what about Karine Jean-Pierre and her cheap fakes and these things? She sustained the opacity regime around the president's health and clemency decisions, you know, publicly minimizing, privately sourcing talking points of unknown authorship, and reinforcing a culture where optics was more important than provenance. Crazy. What about Dr. Kevin O'Connor? His wrongdoing, withholding or failing to document cognition and focused information in public-facing health summaries while the West Wing curated optics. Anita Dunn, senior communications, what did she do? Again, not a crime, but creating a culture that prioritized packaging over content. So thoroughly, the proof of authorship, you can't even find it. The auto pen fiasco wouldn't have happened without her. Couldn't have happened. Senior advisor, Mike Donilon, who wanted to lighten the load, right? His testimony about lightening the president's workload and limiting his events, again, not criminal, just poor management. Man, I tell you what wrongdoing looks like, you know, for all of them. Approval with no author, custody with no log, guidelines with no governance, messaging with no medicine. You know, no treatment. Clemency by email, you know. This is crazy. You know, if you want a prosecutorial bumper sticker, ready? Here's one for you. You can get these printed up and say, Sam said. They replaced the signer with the signature. How about that? That's a punchline, but it's true. Replace the signer with the signature. Why do you need a, you know, that's not theater. That's a documentary remedy. You know, I remember this when I had several staff that I authorized to write checks in my absence when, you know, at my job. And I had a signature stamp. If you authorize somebody to use your signature stamp, it's just like you signing. You've passed off your authority. And it's probably a bad plan. And I did it. But I did it for, you know, small things, you know. Said no stamp over a certain amount of money, you know, $500, something like that. And I really wanted to do more on what these witnesses all said. I don't think I can get through them all. Let's get to just to the bottom line on these because there's so much to go through. Let's take the quote. For specific quotes to each one of these. Jeff Zients, September 18, 2025. Here's the question. Who ran the auto pen? Do you know who ran the auto pen? And he says, I do not. Sorry to laugh about that. Here is Neera Tanden, staff secretary, her interview June 24. Did Biden hand sign all executive orders? She said, he did not hand sign all executive orders. So he didn't. Why not? Ashley Williams, deputy director of the Oval Office. Here's her quote of the day. When pressed on what the process was, Williams conceded she couldn't speak to a formal process on decision making. Ron Klain, former chief of staff, his interview July 24th. His quote, what's a political, why would it be a political problem after the debate when he said, remember he said, we're effed, and he told investigators he knew they had a big problem then. And they said, why a big political problem? He said, because I thought the president's answer had been halting. Steve Ricchetti. Where is his little quote? His quote. the committee was critiquing a culture that treated the auto pen as a convenience, not a legally loaded document. And he said, I don't think so. Age was the consideration. We didn't want him to have to sit down and sign all those documents. He's too damn old. How do you like that? Okay, Mike Donilon, senior advisor. Let's see. What normalizes remote approval? You know, how did that get normalized? And he said, the best approach, he said the same thing as the other guy. The best approach would be to have lightened Biden's schedule load, right? So that's what they were doing it for. Bruce Reed, the model of what you guys were doing makes the auto pen less of an exception and more of a feature. And he said, at times, I sat with President Biden and went through material with him. He did the work and put in the time. At times. I love it. Anita Dunn, her quote, operationally, you're using optics over process. And she says, no, you're asking me to mind read. I don't know. I don't have anything I can say to that. Kim Jean-Pierre, about her binder, she said, nowhere in the book did it exist. And she was asked who wrote it, who put the communications in her binder. Well, that was nowhere in the book. She just got the binder and that was that. She didn't know who wrote it. No idea. Ian Sams. Let's see. He talking about approvals that greenlit auto pen actions without contemporaneous confirmation from Biden. And he said, asked if he met the president to get the president's views first. He just said, I did not. So he had no idea. And he was the guy running the auto pen sometimes. Andrew Bates. How often did you meet the president? And he says, as far as formal meeting, not very frequently. Dr. O'Connor, given that health opacity justified heightened scripting and thus more offsite staff-driven approvals, his silence leaves the auto pen regime's medical predicate question unanswered. And his quote, I invoke the Fifth Amendment and respectfully decline to answer that question. Same thing for Anthony Bernal. Same thing for Annie Tomasini. No, we aren't going to answer that question. Isn't that loopiest of stuff? So the bottom line in plain English, the big part, we can name a specific night, January 19, when the auto pen was used to sign multiple pardons off in an email where the guy said he gave somebody the permission for a slate that included family and high-level names with no decision. We can cite a credible account, or count, I mean, 32 of 51 of these indicating that the auto pen usage was common, not rare. We can quote the staff secretary. Biden did not hand sign EOs. The office didn't track the method. The operator sat in the executive clerk's shop. The chief couldn't name who ran the auto pen. So for executive orders and other actions, auto pen happened, but nobody knows because there's no official roster. We can also add DOJ warning that the communication messaging is untrue and or at least misleading because of the violence, remember that? And that DOJ was largely excluded from the process. Evidence of a rushed, staff-centric clemency process in the same window. So if you're keeping score on all this, the robot's resume definitely includes all the January 19 pardons, probably a big chunk of those clemency warrants to 2,500, and some executive orders, but the Biden White House didn't keep a full ledger, so we don't know. In audit terms, you know, that's not an accident. That's a design choice. When the signature replaces the signer, the remedy should be prove the president approved it or redo it with a human hand. And now it's too late because the president doesn't have any, or that president doesn't have any authority. There are plenty of charges that people are talking about. Clemency by email without a memo, chain of custody violations, guardrails existed but were ignored, verbal approvals, DOJ ethics flags, memo suggesting VP sign-off could suggest for POTUS, apologists and pleading the fifth, and staff management as a complete operating philosophy. Crazy stuff. What does it all mean? So let's land this here plane, shall we? We've walked the paper vapor trail, the robot pen, the telephone, the cheap fake, the Hollywood coaches, the fifths. What does it mean for law, for politics, for a country trying to remember who's supposed to sign their own homework? Start with the Constitution. The presidency isn't a brand, it's a person entrusted with powers that don't travel well without their owner. Clemency is the purest example. The document is not the act. The president's decision is the act. If you replace the decision with an email relay by third parties who weren't even there and a signature with a machine, you haven't streamlined government, you've amputated authorship. That is why the report's blunt remedy is to treat any of these auto pen executed actions as void. This will never happen, but, you know, the point is the pen is not the presidency, the person is. I agree. Now we can layer on what actually happened in the clemency sprint. You know, you've heard all that. It's nonsense. What does that do to finality? Clemency is supposed to end a story. This process is opening a potential sequel. Are these valid? For every controversial grant in that window, beneficiaries who want certainty now have a cloud. Opponents who want to fight have a ladder. Even if no judge ever voids anything, the whiff of voidability isn't going to help. That's why grown-up governments make over-documentation a religion, you know? Crazy stuff. Let's talk culture, because process doesn't, you know, exist in a vacuum. The same shop that normalized verbal now, email later approval and shrugged at not knowing who ran the auto pen, normalized optics is the operating system, teleprompters, lightning the schedule, Hollywood lines, all of this, and a doctor whose public paperwork carefully avoids the question the public is asking. They never asked it at all. You don't need a conspiracy theory when these sorts of incentives are at work. If the priority is protecting his image, authentication isn't nice to have. You know, it would be very nice to have right now, wouldn't it? So, I don't know. What's the political meaning of all this? Two bad options for defenders. Option A, well, this is normal. It's normal to phone the chief at home and authorize robot signing by email from, you know, somebody not in the room, by a person not in the room, to somebody who isn't the president. And I don't know. Maybe you should try to get a restraining order that way, Mr. Attorney. It doesn't work that way. This is logistics. If auto pen versus hand is logistics, then rule of law is a parking ticket. Either way, you've told that public authenticity is negotiable if it's after hours, right? Crazy stuff. What's this mean to the media? Messaging, you know, without provenance is how you talk yourself into a scandal. This is not a scandal. Nothing's ever going to come of this. It's just not going to happen. What should be done? I don't know. Hand-signed clemency, period, in the future. Name the operator. Log the method. Rebuild staff secretary as a witness. Kill verbal then, maybe by email. Publish an auto pen policy. How about that? Audit the backlog. You know, what about all that? I'm not so sure I like this, you know, how this is going. But here's my verdict. This wasn't drama about technology. It was a drama about accountability. The auto pen didn't cause the scandal. It revealed it. A healthy White House could use a robot pen and never fall off a cliff because the paperwork would be bulletproof. Chain of custody, method trackers, operator known of who it was, and above all, the president saying he documented it at the moment it mattered. What we just covered is exactly the opposite. A system that replaced the signer with the signature and hoped no one would notice or check the receipt. We checked, and now you know, at International Flavor, where the truth just tastes better. I plan to see you tomorrow. If you want to go back and listen, or you want to check out other topics in my diatribes, they exist at internationalflavor.com. All of them are out there for your listening pleasure. And JR does a good job of making sure they're also available at damradio.com/podcast. I very much appreciate you for being here. Each and every one of you, have a good night.